From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what changes in federal personnel mean for how we understand the economy?
There was an earthquake just from the firing. But it wasn't just that she was fired. She was fired because he didn't like the data.
Also, looking back on the Vietnam War from the perspective of East Lansing.
There were 36 plus undergraduate students who were enrolled at Michigan State University and killed in the conflict.
Plus, it's a conversation with the Pope's astronomer. The Detroiter who leads the Vatican Observatory talks about the balance of science and spirit.
The reason why we do it, rather than, you know, painting pictures or feeding soup in a soup kitchen, is that we are motivated to do the science as a way of becoming more intimate with the Creator.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, why the Vatican maintains its own observatory and why a Detroiter has led this lab for several decades.
At one end, we've got a guy who's doing the mathematics of quantum gravity, trying to make quantum theory and general relativity work in the Planck time after the beginning of the Big Bang. And at the other end, we've got guys who are looking at interplanetary dust.
Brother Guy Consolmagno is my guest a little later this hour. But first, this month, President Trump replaced someone that you may have never heard of, Erica McIntarfer. She's the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics for the federal government in Washington, D.C. And her ouster got a lot of attention in economics circles. My next guest co-wrote thoughts on this exercise of executive power with two colleagues for the New York Times opinion page, Betsy Stevenson, a professor at the University of Michigan and former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. Betsy, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to talk with you today.
The way things are going within the Trump administration is bringing all federal departments in line with the president's priorities. This churn at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, what thoughts have you had watching the Trump administration try to, you know, get BLS aligned with its goals?
The shock of seeing the BLS commissioner fired, and fired because he didn't like the data, it was earth-shattering to me, because there were several lines there crossed that should not be crossed. The first one that was crossed was just the idea that the president would fire the BLS commissioner. Historically, the BLS commissioner gets a 5-year term, and even if you don't really like them, they're really more of a bureaucrat than they are a political person, and therefore you appoint your own person when that person's term expires, but you don't fire them. I mean, we've all had complaints when it's not our person because they don't do things the way we would want them to do. But it was never, I've never heard it occur to anyone that they're making the data bad, that they are manipulating the data, that they're doing something nefarious, that they should be fired. And so there was an earthquake just from the firing. But it wasn't just that she was fired. She was fired because he didn't like the data. And that sends a really strong message to every single government statistician out there that if you deliver things that the president doesn't like, he is going to try to find a way to get back at you. That culture could destroy, like, our very economy, not just our statistical system.
Can you explain a little bit about what that kind of federal data that the Bureau of Labor Statistics produces is used for? I mean, how was it used when you were in the executive branch?
So it's used for everything. I mean, if you think about one of the reasons why the U.S. is considered a safe haven for investors all over the globe. Investors all over the globe want to invest in the United States. We have what's called a financial account surplus, meaning people invest more in the U.S. than Americans invest abroad. Why is it that people like to invest in the United States? Well, some of it is that we have a reliable government so that they think that there's less risk. But some of it's also that they think that they can really get a good handle on where the U.S. economy is going because we have one of the most reliable statistical agencies in the globe. Countries all over the world emulate the United States statistical agencies because that accurate provision of data reduces uncertainty, which makes it easier for businesses to invest. We also have a government that uses the data for all sorts of things. One is to figure out, is the economy underperforming and should we do something to help it get back to its full potential? Is the economy overperforming and we need to worry about inflation? If so, what kinds of policy levers should we pull? And then there are basics for households. Like if you get Social Security, well, your Social Security is updated for inflation. You want that measure of inflation to be as accurate as possible. If you're about to get your Social Security, they'll often, they're going to mark your how much you get based on the current wage level. Where are they going to get that from? They're going to get that from those employer surveys. So we do want accuracy, and we want it to be unbiased. And what unbiased means is it's not shaped by any kind of political belief.
Can you say a few words about how the Bureau of Labor Statistics gathers its data? I mean, is this just like an office full of people who are crunching numbers, or is there a wider net involved?
There is a wide net. And I think one of the reasons I feel so skeptical about President Trump saying I'm just mad at the BLS because the data has been inaccurate is one of the first things that President Trump did was dismissed all of the statistical technical advisory boards that are comprised of academic statisticians, econometricians, economists who help give advice on how and study ways to improve the accuracy of the data. Those people were all unpaid. So this was not really a cost saving. The only cost was the fact that they were gathering in person to have a meeting to maybe give their free advice and to be that overseer of data accuracy. So those people were all dismissed. They said, we've got the data as accurate as we want it, right? That was the initial claim. I don't believe that that's true. That's one of the real skepticisms I have about the motivation here. The second thing is that, if you think about data collection, there are always a trade-off between three things: timeliness, accuracy, and cost. And one of the things that's been frustrating Congress and frustrating the BLS is Congress would like to see the BLS collect data for less money. Well, if you're doing it with less money, it's either going to be less accurate or it's going to be less timely. The BLS would like to get have more money, not less money, in order to modernize, in order to be able to collect data that's more accurate. We know that there needs to be an improvement in accuracy. And in fact, I, along with a bunch of other economists, signed a letter urging Congress to appropriate the appropriate funds necessary to modernize our statistical system.
You know, it was kind of hard to look at what's going on with the Bureau of Labor Statistics and not think about the pressure that the Trump administration has been exerting on the Federal Reserve and its Board of Governors. Fed Chair Jerome Powell's term ends next May. President Trump has made no bones about the fact that he would like a different chairman. Is there one or the other of these that's more concerning? The possibility of political approaches to data or more influence from the president at an independent central bank?
Honestly, it's all concerning. I will say that pressuring Powell to me was less concerning than firing the BLS commissioner. And the reason is the BLS commissioner, I want everybody to understand this, she had no policy role. She doesn't even really see the numbers until right before they come out. Her primary job is to make sure that the numbers are released in a fair and orderly way. You know, one of the biggest risks for the BLS is if somebody gets a hold of those numbers, even seconds, even milliseconds before someone else, they can make billions of dollars off of it. And that, you know, was something we worried a lot about with algorithmic trading. Is there somebody getting this number and able to upload it into, you know, their trading system so that they can trade just a little bit faster than everybody else? And you might think, well, that sounds kind of boring. Why are you worried about that? You know, you have a retirement account. That retirement account is probably like happily invested, hopefully, in some like nice index bonds, and you're not actively trading. That's a good idea. You don't want to be actively trading, but you don't want other people in the system cheating by trading before anybody else can react to information and news. And that's one of my biggest concerns with the BLS commissioner being a very political person who has friends and enemies, is who's going to get access to the data first. You know, Jerome Powell is actually in a position of making policy, and you know, the president doesn't like his policy. Now, that said, we think that central bank monetary policy should be independent from all other political policy, because otherwise there is a tendency to allow too much inflation in order to have the economy perform well in the short run. And in fact, that's exactly the pressure we're seeing from Trump. What's kind of confusing is that President Trump is simultaneously saying, this economy is amazing, it's so strong, it's on fire, and we need to cut rates because the economy is too slow. And so you can see there the tension. Even President Trump doesn't have an actual view of where the economy is. He has a view on wanting everything to be easy for everyone. But President Trump is more like, you know, that babysitter who's just willing to give as much candy as the kid wants in order for the kid to be happy. That's sort of his attitude towards, like, I don't care if this causes harm in the long run, let's just cut rates now because it'll release some mortgage pressure and people will be happy. And we might end up with 10% inflation, but that's in the future. And I'm thinking about the now. And it's really the Fed's job to be thinking about, you know, we need to keep prices stable because people really rely on price stability. And the Fed has to be weighing that and making sure that Americans don't face ongoing rapid price increases in the wake of those policy choices.
Betsy Stevenson is a professor at the University of Michigan and former chief economist of the U.S. Department of Labor. Betsy, always good to talk.
It's great talking with you.
It's time for a break now. In a moment, it's an exhibit of memories from the Vietnam War as it was experienced at Michigan State. We'll be back in just a moment. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The years of the Vietnam War were tumultuous, of course, for college campuses across the United States. Students taking to the streets to protest, and the draft that signed millions of American young men to fight. Student protesters were certainly present on Michigan State's campus, but the school's involvement in Vietnam went much deeper than that. A friendship between an MSU professor and Ngo Dinh Diem would entangle the university in nation-building effort with disastrous results. And there was more to the story. A new exhibition at the Michigan State Library's main gallery explores the university's complex ties to Vietnam and to the war. With us to talk more about the exhibition is one of its co-curators, Leslie McRoberts. She's the head librarian of Special Collections and University Archives. Leslie, welcome to Stateside. It's very good to have you.
Thank you for having me, April.
Can you set the scene for us? It's the mid-60s on campus, and the United States had been involved in conflict in Vietnam for more than 10 years at that point. What was the campus climate like?
Our campus was one that students and faculty and members of our community would have very much felt a varying tone of presence. There was police presence very much on campus. We have documentation and collections where undergraduates are coming to campus and coming from different parts of the region. Our very own Stephen Murray, who Special Collections is named for, comments in a letter in 1968. He comments about the campus police presence. Students were very much engulfed in something that they felt very strongly about, but also the faculty as well. So you have all of these variations. You have administration that's involved in a lot of ways, President John Hanna and others who were kind of deep into the conflict. You have our students who are resistant against the conflict or who are participating in the conflict. There were 36 plus undergraduate students who were enrolled at Michigan State University and killed in the conflict. And then you have the members of the community who very much had a varying tone, either pro or against the war.
We know that anti-war protests in Ann Arbor and Detroit were large and extremely intense. Is there anything you've been able to divine or figure out about the size and the intensity of the protests in East Lansing?
So in comparison to what was happening in Detroit, what was happening in Ann Arbor, where you had, even in Detroit, where you had higher levels of violence, in East Lansing and then also Lansing, our protests were peaceful. We have documentation that shows a peaceful march from campus to the Capitol building in downtown Lansing. So while the tension was high, there was peace on our campus as best as we could actively demonstrate.
What we didn't yet know at the time, but the documentation in the exhibit can show, is that there was a group of Michigan State faculty in close contact with South Vietnamese leaders, and that even spent time in Vietnam rubbing elbows with the political class. What can you tell me about the Michigan State University Advisory Group, who they were and what their goal was?
The Michigan State University Advisory Group's goal was to help support Ngo Dinh Diem and his regime, to help educate the Vietnamese, to help educate the government, to kind of teach them, I don't want to say political tactics, but to help teach them and support them through a sense of democracy, right? To give them the tools to advise, to educate, to support their country, which, of course, we all know ended very badly.
Wesley Fischel was an MSU professor at the time who was a main point of contact between the university and Diem. How did these two get to be friends in the first place?
So it's my understanding that they became friends through a series of letter writings. Wesley Fischel was a political science faculty member, and he was a South Asian specialist. He understood the different spheres of politics that were happening throughout Southeast Asia and specifically in Vietnam, right? If from a post-French colonial period into the 50s. And he and Diem developed a relationship through letter writing. And I can't speak to how they actually became friends. I think it was more very much on an intellectual level that they were companions and very much needed each other, right? One to boost Fischel's academic strata and then the other for his EM to boost his political strata as he became president of South Vietnam.
Wesley Fischel spent years after the war maintaining that his relationship with Ngo Dinh Diem and its importance were overblown or perhaps just mischaracterized. How do the artifacts in the exhibit either support or complicate that narrative?
I think that when we think about the relationship and that, right, so Fischel tried to he downplayed his relationship and he downplayed his involvement. And he spent years, right, total in time, probably on and off, he was there for 3 to 6 years in country with Diem. Diem came to the Michigan State campus in the 50s and received an honorary degree. So it was a very deep relationship. And so what we see in our exhibition is very much that relationship that they built together. And so it is difficult to deny that there was a deep relationship that was there. And so we have images in the exhibit documenting Diem's visit to campus. But then also we have a broadside in the exhibition calling for Fischel's arrest too. So on top, right, in addition to this bigger relationship that they had, the campus kind of felt very differently about what Fischel was trying to portray.
Some people came to the conclusion that the MSU group basically became a front for the CIA in Vietnam. Do the archives tell us anything conclusive about those accusations?
Not to my knowledge. We do know that there were many CIA on our campus at the time. MSU still maintains a positive relationship with Central Intelligence. It is very much an ongoing relationship. But I do believe that at the time, there were many Central Intelligence on campus.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking today with Leslie McRoberts, MSU's head librarian for special collections and university archives. She is part of the team that curated an exhibit called A Campus and a War that is on view in MSU's library as students return this fall. Leslie, what was the reaction on campus as words started getting out? There was an article that was published in the magazine Ramparts in 1966, an expose about all this. Do you have any evidence of the public's reaction to the news about MSU faculty's involvement in the war?
I think what we see from Ramparts, we see editorials that are written, we see comments that are written back, we see soldiers that are writing in to the state news, giving their perspective, because there is very much a tone that MSU kind of becomes the puppet master, right? In that cover of Ramparts, you have Madame Nu, who is the sister-in-law of Ngo Dinh Diem, and she is wearing an MSU sweater. And so there's very much commentary back that MSU then becomes, right, the Diem regime's puppet. So as we kind of think about, again, going back to that tone that was on campus, there were very strong reactions. There continue to be strong reactions with regard to that cover, that magazine.
Right. Were there conversations among your curatorial team about the things that we can know and the things that we cannot know about that period?
100%. There are things that are concrete information about the war that we know, right? We know that Agent Orange was used. We know that there were 67,000 plus men and women who were killed. We know that MSU was deeply involved in a war. And we even know a member of our own Lansing community was involved in Vietnam ahead of the war. Allison Thomas was a member of DEER Team, so who worked with Ho Chi Minh and Vo Wen Yap. So are there things that we don't know? Absolutely. If anyone who's listening to this and has ever traveled to Vietnam, you can see the remnants of that war on the countryside. You see it in the cities, you see it in the towns, and you see it on the faces of the members of the Vietnamese community. There is a number of things that are unsaid that we will never know. And I think that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people that took information with themselves to their graves. I think those of us from my generation and the generations after me will never know or never understand the deep pain of our involvement in that war.
Let's talk a little bit more about the lives of people who were not overtly involved in the anti-war movement, but who might have had family members or who themselves might have been going to serve. What kinds of records has the collection left us with about what they were going through and the things that were on their minds?
So it's challenging to obtain letters from soldiers and from their families who were in country during the war. A lot of families did not retain their letters or their correspondence or even their recordings. We have soldiers and GIs and nurses were sending tapes back home and not necessarily cassette tapes. These were magnetic reel-to-reel recordings of their experiences. And a lot of those did not survive. So we don't have a lot of information that relates back to the GIs and the students that were there. But when we do get that information, we cherish it and we retain it. We have scrapbooks and we have handfuls of correspondence that were coming from GIs back home. So anything that we have that can tell us more about their experience, the better.
Are there any individual stories that you have found that stand out to you?
I, at one time, held a set of letters that were sent home from a soldier to his parents, and he was explaining to them that he was in love. And he was in country and he had met a Vietnamese woman. It was very common for GIs to have relationships with Vietnamese women. And he was saying, I'm staying with her. We are going to move to another part of the Southeast Asia. They were going to leave Vietnam when he was done with being an active member of the United States military. And it broke my heart because he very much said, why don't you like her? Why don't you like me? Why can't you accept me and my decision? So we see this whole, these feelings and these very hyper concentrated emotions in the materials. The MSU libraries recently acquired a set of audio recordings from a GI that he was stationed on a boat in the South China Sea. We have yet to get those on a reel and get them digitized, but I am so excited to hear what he says. And it's not excited in a yay kind of way, and excited in a way that we will now get to document yet another GI's story. In a past life, I had the pleasure of working with several different members of the military, many of whom served in Vietnam. One was a Green Beret at the Battle of Guay, a nurse at the Battle of Khe Sanh, a baggage handler who was a like he told me, I was at the rung at the bottom of the army, but it saved my life. And so those stories are what we use to then curate exhibits like this. And those experiences help us better understand what was actually happening in our country more than 50 years ago.
Incredible. Leslie, have you or other members of the team been thinking or talking about the rhymes of history as you've been working with the materials for this exhibit? I wonder if as you've been working with the materials, if some of the, some of the things that we've been talking about, the relationship between institutions and military conflict, the relationship that every family has with foreign policy when someone goes to serve, if any of those have felt particularly resonant.
That's a great question. So I think when we think about those different layers of history and how everything is pieced together, for every action, there is a reaction. And in Special Collections in particular, we have a very large radicalism collection. And within that are the voices of both the left and the right. But also, when we think about kind of that left-leaning side, are the voices of the members of the counterculture, and specifically the ones that came out of Detroit, and how one physical structure, right, the Grandy Ballroom, served as a voice, as a pipeline back to not only the bands who were playing on the stage, but the people who showed up for moments of free love and having a safe place. So we see that very much that tenor kind of follows across our own state and across our country. So we see those different connections, and we see them as they go from one generation to the next. Like I had mentioned before about my own generation, I'm a Xennial, and so we know about Vietnam, but we don't know about Vietnam. And even now you hear younger generations say, there was a war? Question mark. And so when we think about those channels of history, it is so deeply important to mount exhibits like the one that we did. So our incoming freshmen who were born a mere 17, 18, 19 years ago, that they can create a touchstone out of that. And maybe they know someone who would have experienced that war.
Leslie McRoberts is a librarian at Michigan State who works with the university's Special Collections and University Archives. Working with her colleagues Garrett Sumner and Jenny Rankin, she helped to curate A Campus and a War, which is on view at MSU through October 3rd. Leslie, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you for having me, April. It's a pleasure.
When you meet someone from another place, how do you talk about who we are?
I'm from Michigan.
The Mitten State.
I live in a flyover state.
I'm in the Upper Peninsula.
The Lower Peninsula.
The Pleasant Peninsula.
I'm in the place with the orange barrels.
No matter how we talk about this state, there are things that connect us all as Michiganders. Like, I bet you point to your hand to tell someone where you're from. That's why we're bringing you a new podcast, On Hand, to answer all your questions about what makes our state special. Like, why do we call ourselves Michiganders?
I think it's a weird thing to say, and it makes me go ill a little bit, but it's what we are, right?
Why do we say pop instead of soda?
I've heard that pop it's starting to fade. Is that right?
And seriously, how many people need to be rescued from Sleeping Bear Dunes every year?
And they look at and see what's still above them, and the mental game kind of kicks in. It's kind of what we call a failure to thrive.
Rescue costs $3,000. Keep yourself and our rescuers out of danger.
I'm host April Baer. The team at On Hand wants to answer your questions. This whole podcast is about getting to the root of your burning Michigan curiosities and finding experts that have the answers. Ever wanted to know the secret recipe of rock and rye Faygo? Or find out why the federal government investigated Juggalos? You guys, we're here to find out for you. If you have a question or even a story to share, you can email us at onhand@michiganpublic.org. Or you can submit through the handy form. Just click the link in the pod notes. We can't wait to get started answering your questions. The first answer drops with the pod on September 5th. Subscribe now to On Hand, a Michigan podcast. See you soon. It's time to break. When we come back, we'll contemplate the heavens with the director of the Vatican Observatory.
God made the universe. My religion tells me that. This is how we made the universe. My science tells me that.
Stick around. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. How about a little change of perspective? And by a little, I mean way, all the way out into the galaxy. We've been thinking about the ways that we as humans make sense of the world around us and the lives we live. Some are guided by the path of the stars and the planets, and others turn to the heavens in a different way. In spirituality. Humans have been debating whether or not these two things are mutually exclusive for centuries. Like any good argument, there's a spot in the middle where things overlap. At this intersection is the Vatican Observatory, an astronomical facility that's been around since 1582. It's made up of a dozen priests and Jesuit brothers from around the world who study the universe using modern scientific technique. And the director of the observatory is Brother Guy Consolmagno, who also happens to be a Detroit expat. Brother Guy, welcome to Stateside. It's so good to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I was absolutely floored to learn that the Vatican has maintained an observatory for this long. When did you first visit? Had you ever been there before you began your work?
I didn't visit there until I started the work, but I knew about them because the director back when I joined in the 90s was another American whose name was George Coyne. And when I had been a graduate student at the University of Arizona, he was on the faculty there. So I knew of the Vatican Observatory from that. But to be frank, I remember hearing about there being a Vatican Observatory from the nuns who taught me at Our Lady Queen of Martyrs back in, you know, Berkeley, Michigan.
Oh, my gosh. The Vatican's a sovereign state, of course, so I guess it makes sense that it would have some scientific interests.
Well, it has a national observatory in part to emphasize that it's a sovereign state.
Right. Right. Well, what kind of work is the observatory involved in? Can you tell us a little bit about what the days are like?
When I arrived, my assignment was do good science. And since I've been the director, I've told that to all the new people. It means that the dozen scientists that we have are all pursuing whatever research they were interested in when they were getting their doctorates before they came to us. And it covers the entire spectrum of what's going on in astronomy. At one end, we've got a guy who's doing the mathematics of quantum gravity, trying to make quantum theory and general relativity work in the Planck time after the beginning of the Big Bang. And at the other end, we've got guys who are looking at interplanetary dust and near-Earth asteroids, things much closer to home. And in my case, meteorites, you know, the rocks that actually fall onto the Earth from the asteroid belt. But in between, we've got people who do work on the evolution of galaxies. The new director, who will be taking over from me when my term ends in September, actually did his postdoctoral work at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor on the evolution of galaxies. So this is just an example of the spread of things we're doing.
You mentioned your own work in meteorites. I understand that the observatory has a really excellent collection.
It's a fabulous collection, and one of those little minor miracles that you have to just, you sort of laugh, is God really trying to tell me something? When I was a scientist before I was a Jesuit, I was doing theoretical work, and I needed numbers to put into my programs to make the programs work, and the numbers didn't exist. You know, what is the density of a meteorite? What is its thermal properties? I show up at the observatory and discover there's 1,000 meteorites, a little bit of every type, ideal for making these measurements. And suddenly I said, well, here I am. I guess that's what I should be doing. And those are the measurements I've been doing for the last 30 years.
What sparked your interest in astronomy as a young person?
Well, I was a Sputnik kid. You know, I was a baby boomer. When I started kindergarten, that was the year that Sputnik was launched. When I was finishing up my last year at U of D High, that was the year that people landed on the moon. And all during that time, space was everywhere. But in addition, spending summers up in the shores of Lake Huron, you could see the stars, and that was spectacular. And my father had always loved astronomy. He'd learned it in particular to be a navigator in B-17s during the war. So he taught me the astronomy. He taught me the constellations.
Yeah. There have been times when science and the church did not enjoy such a close relationship. You mentioned the fact that everyone who works at the observatory is encouraged to pursue their projects, you know, just in whatever way seems to produce the best science. How would you explain how the staff at the observatory considers the balance of science and spirit in their daily work?
Well, first of all, the history is a lot more complicated than the simple picture that most people think. Science was invented by the church. It was invented at the universities that the church runs. Because real science, I'm not talking about making cell phones or cool technology, but just studying the universe for the fact that it's interesting is an act of worship. And a culture that supports this is a culture that sees the universe as the creation of God, and therefore worthy of study because it's a place where we find God. That's why there have been church people doing science since long before Galileo and during Galileo and after Galileo. And Galileo is usually the one example people bring up because I can't think of any other one. That still is true today. We do the science that we find interesting and that, you know, allows us to be part of the conversation about science with all of our fellow scientists from all over the world, all different religions. But the reason why we do it, rather than, you know, painting pictures or feeding soup in a soup kitchen, is that we are motivated to do the science as a way of becoming more intimate with the Creator.
Have you ever found that your work has challenged your sense of spirituality or your faith?
Sadly, no. And I say sadly because every time you are challenged, you learn something. Now, it's never happened that this bit of science opposes this bit of religion. But what does happen is that this bit of science challenges this other bit of science. And that's when you get excited because you say, I'm going to get a paper out of this. Oh, I'm going to learn something new. So these kinds of challenges are really things that you would look forward to. Now, the reason it doesn't happen very often is because the science and the religion aren't exactly talking about the same thing. To put it simply, God made the universe. My religion tells me that. This is how we made the universe. My science tells me that.
I suppose it's safe to say that there's enough to test faith here on Earth without having to look through a telescope to
absolutely.
To try to find such things.
And in fact, what you do find looking through the telescope reaffirms your faith. It reminds you that in spite of the horrible things that we have to deal with here on Earth, the universe is ultimately beautiful. The universe is ultimately something that makes sense. And the universe is something that will last longer than you know, the collapse of my favorite football team, or whatever politics are happening now, or whatever I'm going through in my relationships with my friends or my spouse or whatever, that the universe will be there, the sun will rise tomorrow, and sort of thumb its nose at all the people who want to make you think that life is miserable.
You know, over the course of your professional life, astronomy itself has gone through so many changes. It's always been deeply concerned with math and physics, of course, but much of the equipment that is used now is not exactly looking through a lens to see things in the way that it would have been even 75 years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of equipment that the observatory has at its disposal?
One of the big changes, and I'm an example of this, is that it's more than math and physics, it's also become geology. I'm one of the first generation of people who do planetary sciences with a geology background, because I'm doing the geology of other planets, even as I'm learning how to use the telescopes. The space telescopes are wonderful, and yet in some ways, they're just, you know, more and more clever technology utilizing an understanding of science that's been around for a while. Being able to look at light and split it into its colors and use those colors to determine what chemical elements are present, that's been around since the 1860s. And incidentally, the first guy who did that systematically was a Jesuit priest who did it in a telescope in the roof of a church in Rome. And we're very proud of Angelo Secchi. But the new instruments that we have, of course, are modern computers. And we have in our meteorite lab a number of bits of instrument, for instance, just to measure the density of a rock, the density of a meteorite. You want to know its weight? Yeah, we've had scales for a long time. You want to know its volume and what's the weight to volume ratio. Well, how do you measure the volume of an irregular rock? Archimedes said you could dump it in water, but I'm not going to dunk a meteorite in water. It's going to hurt the meteorite. Today, we can scan it with a laser and take that laser scan into a computer and make a computer calculation of the volume of the rock.
My guest today is director of the Vatican Observatory, Brother Guy Consolmagno. He is also a graduate of University of Detroit Jesuit High School, and he grew up in the city. Brother Guy, I guess the one thread that I find in the careers of every scientist I've ever talked to is the struggle with budget problems. You know, there's always more that can be done if funds are inexhaustible. Here in the States, a lot of scientists have been going through some, shall we say, challenging times with federal funding. Is the observatory in a place where the Vatican is still able to fund the things that you really want to do and that you're concerned with?
We are incredibly fortunate in that regard. Our budget is one half of 1% of the Vatican City State's budget, which is actually what NASA's budget is of the United States budget. That's a little bit bigger, so we're not building rockets. But we have, both by being Jesuits, so that our living costs are very low because we live together in a community, but our science has been steadily funded by the Vatican City State. We're able to go to meetings. We're able to travel to meetings. We're able to travel from Rome to Tucson and back to use our telescope here. The one challenge is the money for the telescope, because the telescope that we have here in Arizona, which is, you know, why I'm in Tucson half the year, that telescope is run by a foundation, a private foundation that supports the Vatican Observatory. And so one of my jobs is, you know, private fundraising. But there are a lot of good, interesting, basically Catholic engineers who get a sense of what we're doing and why we're doing it. And we've been very fortunate in the people who have supported us that way. The one challenge was during COVID, because the Vatican City State gets most of its funding from the income from the Vatican museums. Mm. And when the museum was shut down for a year, that put everybody into a panic. Fortunately, it's recovered, and, you know, the tourism is bigger and better than ever.
I know. I understand that budgets aren't quite this cut and dried, but it is a fact now that the Holy Father is an American. One would hope that you might have something of a pipeline to bend his ear on the subject of budget matters. Have you had a chance to meet him yet?
I've met him once. We have a summer school every 2 years, kids from 25 incredibly bright students from around the world, and we always try to get a papal audience. We had arranged with Pope Francis for an audience. Francis sadly died. Leo kept the audience, and he actually came in to visit these guys with a statement that he had worked on that showed that he really understood who they were and what they were about. You know, he just didn't walk into the room and say hi and walk out. He understood us. He also came out to Castel Gandolfo, where we're located, for a summer vacation and asked to look through the telescopes. So that shows an interest in what we're doing. The one thing you worry about, though, is, of course, the Pope has to bend over backwards to look fair. And that means in some cases, maybe being an American is a drawback because he has to show he's not being favoritism to the Americans. On the other hand, you know, when we talk to him, we can understand each other much more easily than somebody who's, you know, stumbling in Italian like I do. Mm.
It's also comforting to know that there would be some shared culture in between a tiger sky and a White Sox sky. Oh, excuse me, a
well,
Cubs
that
sky.
Could also, yeah, that could be a little point of conflict. I made sure not to wear my Tigers cap when I saw the Pope.
You're going to be coming over our way in September for the Astronomy at the Beach event in Detroit to give a talk. Can you share a little bit more about what you have in mind for the crowd?
Well, the crowd is basically a bunch of people either interested in astronomy because they have telescopes and they want to see the latest and greatest, or they don't have telescopes and they just want to see what astronomy is about. There are going to be a lot of amateur telescopes set up. My job is to give a little perspective on the theme for this year, which is Saturn. And going back to my very first research as an undergraduate more than 50 years ago, I've been fascinated by the rings of Saturn and the moons of Saturn, what they're made out of and what we've learned about them. And what happens when you get old and gray like me is you start telling history stories as well as the latest research. So I'm going to tell a little bit of the foolish and wonderful mistakes we made in the past with an eye towards where are the foolish and wonderful mistakes we're making right now and where are the exciting things that we'll learn when we discover those mistakes.
Do you mean the things that we now take for granted that future generations will look at and say, well, of course that wasn't true?
Exactly. And that's the whole joy of astronomy. You know, if you write a scientific paper and within 10 years somebody hasn't corrected it and improved on it, it means that nobody bothered to read it. So our entire life is dedicated to making ourselves obsolete.
What do you wish that the average stargazer, just sort of tilting a head up and trying to see what they can see, what do you wish people better understood about Saturn?
Well, I think people will be amazed to know that the rings, according to our latest ideas, are relatively new, that the solar system is evolving continually, it's changing continually, and that sometimes the glory of the ring blinds us to the interesting planet inside those rings.
What is Saturn like? I remember from high school science that it's got a very much more heavily gassy atmosphere than we do.
Well, it is gas, basically, with a couple of percent of rock maybe vaporized inside. The pressures inside are so high that you really couldn't even call it rock anymore. It's a superfluid kind of matter. There are some things about it which are fascinating. Jupiter has got all of these colorful clouds. We think Saturn is made out of the same stuff, but it doesn't have all the colors. It's more of this beautiful golden shade with all the different colors. That's interesting. Saturn and Jupiter both have magnetic fields, but Saturn's magnetic field is at an angle that's hard for our theories to understand. And you're always excited when you see something and you go, huh, that's funny. In that sense, it's wonderful because we've got more than one example of a giant gaseous planet. And we can say, these are the things they have in common. These are the things that are different. You turn this knob, that happens. Now I know what this knob does.
Brother Guy, you mentioned the fact that your term as director of the observatory is ending in September. Have you given much thought to what you're going to do next?
Well, I have three jobs. Now I'll only have two. And one of the jobs is going around, especially in North America, giving public talks like the one I'm giving at the end of September. But I give a lot of those. The whole reason the Vatican supports an observatory is to show the world that the church loves and supports science. And somebody's got to go out there and show the world. So I'm happy to do that. And I'll probably be doing more of that in North America. But I've also got to keep the science up that I'm doing. And I hope to be able to spend a little more time in the science that I've had to put out to the side while I was a director.
Brother Guy Consolmagno is the director of the Vatican Observatory. And as I mentioned, he's going to be coming to Detroit this fall for a talk at the Astronomy at the Beach event. Brother Guy, thank you so very much for taking a few minutes to talk to us. It's really been a pleasure.
It's been a delight, and I'm looking forward to getting back to Michigan.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you again tomorrow.